Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Hello, everyone. It's a beautiful day here. Sun shining.
And Mom's in Iowa, where she usually is, almost always.
Yep.
And I'm in Texas, where I am part of the time, and the rest of the time I'm usually in Iowa. And who do we have with us today, Mom?
Well, today we have a very interesting book and an interesting author as well. The book is Beheld, and it's by Tarashia, is that how you pronounce it? Tarashia Nesbitt, and she's the author of The Wives of Los Alamos, which was a national bestseller, a finalist for the Penn Bingham Prize and a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice, among other things. Her writing has been featured in Granta, The Guardian, Fourth Genre, Salon, and elsewhere. She is now an associate professor in the creative writing program at Miami University, and she lives in southwestern Ohio with her family. And this book is very interesting.
And the title of it is Beheld. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Tara Shea.
Thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure.
So Beheld is very timely for this time of year because we're coming right up on Thanksgiving. And in fact, some of you will probably be listening to this after Thanksgiving, and which, you know, in our sort of culture is a celebration of a myth of the pilgrims in Plymouth, Massachusetts. And that is the subject matter of this historical novel, Beheld. What inspired you to write this?
Yeah, you know, it was a couple different things were coming together. I had finished my first book, The Wives of Los Alamos, and I knew that I was really interested in turning points in American history where I thought I knew the story of what happened, but there was something else, or at least more than one thing going on. And I wanted to tell the story from the perspective of women. And so I was looking around for a story, and I came across William Bradford's book of Plymouth Plantation. William Bradford was the longstanding governor of Plymouth. I didn't know that at the time, but now I do. And in his account of the colony, he lays out what happened that first winter and what the colony was all about from his perspective as someone who had left Holland and was trying to form a colony. But he leaves out the death of one person when the ship is moored off of what is now Provincetown Harbor. And I noticed in a footnote in that book that he had left out the cause of death. And I wondered what happened. And the cause of the person whose death he left out was the cause of death of his own wife, his first wife. And so I immediately was like, wait a minute here. I did not know, number one, that someone died on the Mayflower when it was moored off of what is now Provincetown Harbor. Nor did I know that the longstanding governor had a first wife who perished right at the time that the ship arrived. And I thought, if he's leaving out this, what else could he be leaving out of the Mayflower story? And it turns out there was a lot.
Oh, wow. And how were other people keeping accounts of it so that you were able to find contemporaneous accounts?
So there were no accounts of what happened with her, but what I was, so the way that the story has gotten told very lightly is that, you know, I hadn't heard of it, but it had been told like 80 years later. Cotton Mather said in a kind of celebration of life for William Bradford that his first wife had slipped off the ship, but he wasn't there. And no one else speaks of it. And it seems to me that, so then I started going like, well, what else was going on with her? She had left behind her only living son in Holland. She was experiencing scurvy, probably. There was a lot of like old wounds, long thought healed, reemerging. That's a definition of what scurvy can do, but it's also, I think, an emotional understanding. So I had that, and then I started to look at the Plymouth court records, and I saw that first court case happened 10 years after they arrived, but it involved people that were on the Mayflower. And I started to see this connection between the people that were on the Mayflower that were definitely not the religious extremists that Bradford was a part of, and his first wife's death. And so I started to write into those. But I could find, like, there's a book by Thomas Morton called The New Canon, and he's writing at the time that all of this is going down. And he was really critical of Plymouth Colony, and he said that the Billington family, so a family that features heavily in the book, that they were mistreated throughout. And so I did have a primary account from someone who was living there at the time that had a really critical look at who was leading Plymouth. And I could find some letters from other people describing some things that kind of countered the narrative that I thought I knew and that I had been told about who these people were.
Now, do you have a background as a historical researcher?
You know, I think I probably would have been a historian if I wasn't a writer, if I wasn't, you know, fabricating. But I definitely was learning in my first book as I went along. Like, that book was a lot of talking to historians and listening to oral histories to try to find out what life was like for women who lived in Los Alamos while their husbands were building the bomb. And so this book was similarly like immersion. I would immerse myself and I would go to Plymouth, and I had a residency at the American Antiquarian Society, and I would look at archives and talk to all kinds of different people about their take on history, talk to a lot of historians. But yeah, you know, the thing is, like, I think that I'm drawn to areas where there are real gaps in the storylines. There aren't archives, the women weren't writing letters. And that's part why I go to fiction, because I can only, you know, as a historian, I could only so imagine so much. And as a writer, I can say, well, I'm having a conversation with the past. I'm not exactly asserting this is true. And that feels more comfortable.
Now, you're writing this at a time when there's really some serious pushback against these truths or these, you know, the uncovering of the myth, basically, of our founding, of our history of American history, and that there seems to be some people who would like it all to just stay hidden. Have you had any pushback on that?
No, I haven't. I think when I initially started researching the book, one thing I encountered were people that had relatives from the Mayflower ship that were really attached to the kind of ancestor worship, for a better term, of their ancestors. And so at one time I emailed someone and I offhandedly said something like, oh yeah, were the Puritans, as you understand them, like this? And this was like a historical society, but those people also came from Mayflower lineage. And the person wrote back and said, we don't call ourselves Puritans. We call ourselves pilgrims. And yeah. First of all, I was really struck. I was like, we? Like, this was 100 years ago. And also, Puritan was the term that was used, the derogatory term of the time, because they were really seen as extremist, but pilgrim was the term that Bradford gives us as a way of like valorizing that initial white settler colonialism. So I haven't gotten into the fray too much, but it's early on. You know, the book is new in paperback and it's been published for just a little over a year in the hardback. So there's always the chance.
Yeah. It's, tell us about the multiple perspectives that the book is written from. Who are your point of view characters, and how did you arrive at those as the point of view characters? And they aren't all women.
No, they aren't. So the novel opens, for readers who haven't read, listeners who haven't read the book yet, the novel opens with this governor's second wife recalling the day that the first murder of a colonist within Plymouth Colony occurs. So the span of the novel is that day with some flashback to backstory and history and time in Holland. And then it ends a little in the more at the end of the characters' lives, mostly. So we open with Alice Bradford, and then the second chapter is from John Billington's point of view. And John Billington was famously hated by William Bradford. And his house was in real life right next to William Bradford's. And the Billingtons were not, you know, they did not practice religion as Bradford did. And their sons, like, really did almost set the Mayflower on fire by getting into the gunpowder. And they were raucous and dissenting and kind of rebellious and really fun to write. So you have Alice Bradford, and then you have John Billington, and then you have John Billington's wife, Eleanor Bradford, who was even more fun to write because she's setting out to tell you what happened that day from a very different point of view than the governor's wife. And she's mad and she's angry about her, you know, what she inadvertently got herself into in Plymouth. And so we go back and forth. There's also a chapter where we see nature. This is just the point of view of all the drama as seen by the plants and animals around. And a little bit of other people kind of come into the fray at the end, but primarily you get the story from a newcomer, John Newcomen, the Billington husband and wife, and Alice Bradford.
And you don't really get into too much into the perspective of the Native Americans who were there, although you do kind of cast a little bit of, say, you know, maybe what the story that William Bradford and Miles Standish tell about the interactions and how the colony succeeded isn't being entirely fair to the Native Americans.
Yeah, that's true. That was a really conscious choice. I wanted to critique the colony from within. It seemed to me that all of the problems were arising from the people that were within the palisade. And so I spent a lot of time with them, looking critically at who they were, sort of what was motivating them. They had a lot of financial debt and other things. But when I was near the first draft of the book and getting revision work done, I did consult with a member of the Wampanoag community who read the book and gave me feedback because it seemed, you know, really important that I wasn't going to misrepresent. And they pointed out really great things about things I had overlooked or not really thought of. So near the end of the book, there is a motioning towards later wars that happen and how during those wars, which were mostly fought over waterways and land, continued white encroachment, Native American men and women some of them are taken and then enslaved within those communities. And that was an aspect that I really hadn't thought of. And it's hard to find some archives unless you're within communities looking for oral histories, you know, the want to like retell the same narrative of valor. You can find that story really easily, but it becomes a little harder to find those counter stories.
Yeah, that isn't something that we were ever told or taught, that they enslaved the Native Americans. And just one of the things that kind of carried throughout the book was this, the fact that one of a Native American's head was displayed above the meeting house for
Yes.
years and years and years.
That's right. That was true. That was taken from letters, descriptions of the meeting house. And the story with that was their hired soldier. So I should back up and say that, you know, the Mayflower, it was like the religious extremists of Bradford and who we think of as the Pilgrims. Then all their hired help, like the carpenters and the one site hired soldier, Miles Standish, and then their indentured servants. So people that had said like, okay, I'll work for you for 7 years and then you give me land. They don't get some land. And as I've imagined, the Billingtons, they're the indentured servants of their time, though technically I can't say whether that was true or not, but there were indentured servants. In fact, there's this whole other story of like kids that were sent away by their father without their mother's knowledge who were actually indentured servants to the Mayflower. And I could only get it in a little bit in the book, but it was such a horrifying and fascinating story. But anyway, so the thing with the head on a stake was Miles Standish was, he was, you know, that whole area had tons of trading posts. There were tons of Native American communities thriving or at various stages of illnesses, but it was a very populated place, which was new to me to imagine. And Miles Standish goes to Wessagusset under the pretense of trade. And after hearing that a Massachusetts man, so Massachusetts Native American man, was teasing him, and because Miles Standish was very short, and he said, "You're so short. Are you even a man?" And Standish got really mad, as the story goes, and organized the militia, which would be men within the Plymouth Colony, the elders and leaders, and others, to go to Wessagusset, pretend like they were going to trade, lock the doors, and then kill Massachusetts men. And they did, including one boy. And they took the leader, one of the leaders' head, and wrapped it in a cloth. And he proudly gallops back to Plymouth and erects the head on a stake above the meeting house. I mean, for context, heads on a stake, like that was actually a common English gruesome thing. You would see that, like you'd go by a castle and there'd be all these heads, horrifying. But context, but still, so there was this head, and then he erected the linen as a flag. So you had this bloody waving flag, and that kind of like view of Plymouth colonists is really violent. You know, don't mess with us, here we are. That also something I hadn't thought of. And so then Bradford writes to their pastor, because they didn't bring their pastor, you know. I was like, hey, this is a story of religious freedom. No, actually, they already had it in Holland, and their pastor was like, no, I'm needed in Holland, I'm not going to come. So he writes, Bradford writes to his pastor, Robinson, kind of saying, hey, look what we did, you know, bragging a little bit. And Robinson writes back and says, basically, we watch out for that Standish. He's a hothead. And where there is bloodshed, there will be more. A shame it was that you didn't try to convert some of them. So a lot of Christian conversion stuff, but also warning against committing violence. And that reshaped something for me. Like, oh, these Plymouth colonists were being warned by their own pastor not to be violent. And they were quite violent when they wanted to be. Especially perhaps because of the kind of leader that they hired in Miles Standish.
We all have this sort of image that the pilgrims were the first people in that area, certainly the first white people, but there were quite a few other settlements in the area too, weren't there?
Yeah, there were. I mean, there were, we know the Virginia colony. They were actually trying to get, or they say they were trying to get to the Virginia colony. So you already had establishments, English establishments further south. But even further south, you had Spanish settlements, which is partly why they didn't want to go further south, was to try to, you know, be further from the Spanish. But also for the people who were already in Holland, I mean, they were immigrants in exile in Holland, they were invited by Holland to like just come join us in New Amsterdam, which is about like, you know, New York City area. Come join us there. And they said no, because then we would be among the Dutch. And they really didn't want to be among the Dutch. They thought the Dutch were too permissive, and they didn't want their kids to be intermarrying, as they said. So it was already a very populated area before that. You had fur trappers, you had adventurers, people just coming to explore. But then you had all of these Native American communities in and around the northeastern woodlands, and then, of course, further south and west. So, yeah, I looked at maps. They're the Foster maps. I think they're from the 1670s, so a little bit later, but you can just see in those maps, they map out the Native American communities and the trading posts. And I was stunned. Like, this was a very, there were a lot of things here already. But what was somewhat new is that these people brought their families. And so they weren't just men coming in to take things, but they were putting their communities atop Patuxent, a community that was already there, but people had died. And establishing themselves and their roots, and they weren't leaving. and that was somewhat new for that area.
And the Pilgrims / Puritans weren't actually supposed to be on the Mayflower at all.
Yeah, that's right. So wild.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Yeah, they were supposed to be on the Speedwell, and then, you know, I'd always heard like the Speedwell caught a leak or something, but in looking at, I spent a really deep dive in the economic history of Plymouth and reading all these letters between Bradford and people that they had within their community that were going to London to try to navigate getting a charter and getting financial backing. What I got from all of that was that they grumpily had to be part of two ships. They didn't even really want the Mayflower, but they needed a little more room and they needed to store the indentured servants and they needed to let in some adventurers so they could pay off their debt faster because they owed money already for the ship's voyage. And so they were on the Speedwell and it sounded like, you know, there were all these delays and then it was going to be a trip across the Atlantic in the winter or in the incoming fall. And I think that the ship's captain just was like, I'm out. Like, I don't want to make this trip. But because of all the delays, they were acquiring more debt because they had to stay in these boarding houses waiting for the ship to be ready for them to go. And that was, so they had to sell certain things. And Bradford was Bradford wasn't the only leader at the time. They actually had a head leader, but he died fairly soon after the arrival. So, yeah, so they were going to be on the Speedwell, and then they had to join with the Mayflower passengers, who were mostly Anglican. And I just imagine there were a lot of fights about the differences in religious practice or just daily practice, like can you dance, can you sing, how do you get along? And if you look at Bradford's letters, I mean, he gets mad sometimes. He gets really mad. There's some mean sailor who comes down and is like, I hope to throw half of you overboard by the ship's journey's end. And then Bradford really somewhat gleefully exclaims later, like, he died and like God had his way with him. So it sounds like it was probably a mess.
Throughout the book, you have anytime something good happens, it's God's blessing, and anything something bad happens, it's God testing them. And so it's like a win-win. That's horrible. You know?
Yeah. I think for the separatist Puritans, for the Puritans, the people who are like, we need to change the church, but we can't do it from within. So for all those people, like their frame of reference and understanding the world, it's still even now fuzzy to me, to be honest, but I did get this sense that when something was good, it was God shining a light. And when there are hard things, we have to think that we're being tested. That's the kind of language they would use to describe it. That's also maybe a reason why Bradford doesn't mention his first wife's death, because it doesn't fit into that narrative. Like, if she was she pushed off? Did she jump? Did she slip? And it's harder to talk about that in reference to God, I think, which is one thing I wonder about why he didn't go into it, because it didn't fit that.
I want to back up a moment and talk about how, so the government in England owned all this land, right? They owned America then. And then these people had to pay to come over and farm it or whatever they did. Is that how it worked? I mean, I'd never realized that, I guess.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. So the land ownership was kind of tricky. But there was the Virginia colony. I mean, tricky is an understatement. Land ownership was like, hey, this is mine. I'll be taking this. And if someone was there to be like, no, then, you know, then that didn't go down well. But the Virginia colony was an established colony at the time. And so further south, but not as south as like what is now Virginia. And so what they got was like a charter, the king's kind of blessing to come to Virginia colony, but to be maybe far enough away, like to have their own kind of community. And who they would owe money to is the merchant, and what are they called? Something like Merchant Adventurers. I forget the name of the company, but there was a particular company that they paid for the voyage and for the kind of startup costs, let's say, for forming a community. So giving them, helping them in the, you know, hiring the, getting the boat, getting the captain, getting the crew, and then bringing other things aboard, getting their supplies. There were arguments arguments all the time about like that person brought all this stuff on board and like we're not seeing it, like the people who are managing their money that from the company. So they had a debt when they arrived that they took a while to pay off. But I think that having a debt probably shaped their actions in ways. You know, they were fur trapping, like getting furs would be a way to pay off debt.
I was going to ask about that. So they had to send goods back that they had somehow grown or, you know, like you say, animal pelts, send back to pay this debt.
Yes.
And so that was interesting. I never even, you know, you never thought about that. That was really interesting.
They did this other thing. You know, they were writing these pamphlets advertising the colony in the early years. And I hadn't thought about that. Like they needed to advertise the colony to bring in more people to do more work to pay off their debt. So they would advertise it as being, you know, this fabulous place. Meanwhile, you can look around those pamphlets and see, well, they're advertisements. You know, those are brochures. And
slightly exaggerated, perhaps.
Yes. Yes, there wasn't quite as much fish. The land was not very fertile, and you know, like it was very rocky. A little bit of an elaboration for sure.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Tara Shea Nesbitt, author of Beheld. So, as you said, they were trying to recruit more people to come, but when newcomers arrived, there was kind of, they were a burden to the community until they were able to sort of get on their feet, right?
Yeah. Their way of working together changed a couple times. Like there was this initial, we share the pot, and then that became complicated and people felt like other people weren't doing their share. Depending on when newcomers arrived, there was a different strategy. But the merchant adventurers and the company they'd come and like assess how the colony was doing, but they would also sometimes just bring people on a ship and be like, hey, we've got these people for you. And that itself caused a lot of problems. Like I read documents where they're talking about a ship arrives with all of these kind of rowdy men and they like take take our corn before it's ripe. It's like early spring. And then they like they kind of pillage with their supplies. And then they head off north to start their own kind of colony. So I think they probably grew increasingly leery of newcomers because of previous history of people just coming and honestly doing what they did, which is like, and their time, like they dug up, you know, they dug up graves and would find some corn stores and be like, hey, this is good. We'll start seeding out of a sense of necessity. But I think it was.
Yeah, we were talking about land ownership and, you know, the King of England having claimed and giving out charters for this land, but it didn't really belong to him in any true sense of the word. It was the home of all these Native American tribes who lived there, and they didn't have the same concept of land ownership as Europe did at the time.
Yeah,
how did they look at it?
It was definitely a sense of a shared places being shared and used differently seasonally. I certainly can't speak for all of the Native American communities. So many of them are, you know, have been here for thousands of years and are still here today. But the I did notice, like, there were these court cases where Wampanoag community members would come in and be like, your cows or your pigs are, let's see, cows or pigs, some of your animals are trampling our crops. I think it was pigs.
Yeah.
And they would be like, oh, it's not our fault. You know, at some point they were like, oh, sorry. And then they were like, no. You know, as the colony expands, it seems to me that the sense of, as the colony expands and the generations move forward, it's, you can see that that initial interaction and potential care for the communities surrounding Plymouth are lessened such that they will say like, oh, that's not our responsibility anymore. And Standish is an early claimer of land in Duxbury, like in further northeast. So they just start taking, I mean, they just start taking around. And they had a pastor, Roger Williams, because they couldn't keep a pastor, and for various reasons, usually because the pastors would point out their own hypocrisy and they didn't like that. But so one time, twice pastors wanted to preach to the Anglicans, indentured servants and otherwise, and they were like asked to leave. But Roger Williams pointed out, like, who do you owe for this land? Don't you owe someone? He was also asked to leave, I think, under questioning about that, the fact that he was questioning it. So that's right. No one owned this land as much as there were communities that had lived here for thousands of years. And white settlers just come and start erecting things and saying it's theirs.
It's kind of amazing that the people who were there first allowed them to do this, basically let them come and build things and didn't slaughter them all.
Yeah, that was just what I was going to say. That is amazing, considering what happened later on as we moved westward in the country and had the difficulty with the Indian tribes and tried to, you know, and that's very interesting.
Yeah, I think there's probably a lot going on there. I mean, there are stories like they try to settle more on the a different part of Massachusetts, like on the coast, a different part of the coast, and they were definitely met with like Native American people who were showing that they were not going to let them settle there. So mm-hmm. I think it could have been particular to where what was going on particularly there, but certainly, you know, I mean, this definitely all goes back to when we're celebrating something like Thanksgiving, and in Plymouth you have this parade. Well, they call themselves America's hometown, like that's the advertisement for the community, and there's a parade on Thanksgiving, but then there's also a day of mourning where Native American people and allies go to Coal Hill and honor the Wampanoag leader who was working in tandem with Bradford at the time, and acknowledge this as like that day as the, or that acknowledge the Puritans as the real threshold start of white settler colonialism for that area.
Tara Shea, how about you read some from Beheld for us?
Sure, I'd love to. I'm going to read from the two main points of view. So first I'll start with I'll start with Alice Bradford, and you can get a sense of her voice. She definitely, I think, sounds a little more formal. And then I'll move into Eleanor Bradford, who is just more casual with us. Alice Bradford. We thought ourselves a murderless colony. In God's good favor, we created a place on a hill overlooking the sea and the direction from which we came. For a while, God's favor seemed possible, but it pleased him to have other plans. I remember that day and the year of our Lord, 1630, that the first colonist was murdered. We were divided, as we had been from the beginning. Half of the colonists were congregants striving to live as God intended, and the other half, well, they were why we took care to mend the fences. It was August, the month of promises fulfilled or never realized. Our harvest had been bountiful, acres of nearly ripe corn, beans, and squash. I had three living children with me in Plymouth. William the younger was 6, Mercy was 3, already feeding herself porridge, and gentle with the newborn Joseph when reminded. My two eldest were still in Holland. At 40 years of age, I was, for the final time, a new mother. Joseph, 2 weeks old, newly whelped. I was blessed to have so many healthy children. My husband saw the ship's arrival first. He lifted the oiled cloth on the window and said, "They'll be here by supper." The newcomers were at least a week past due. Young William followed his father nearly always, including that morning, climbing up on a chair to see out the window. Though he unbalanced, fell backward. His skull knocked against the floor. He jumped and gave the baby to his father. I jumped and gave the baby to his father. Everything could have been a sign for what was to come. Downward to the sea was the shore, and a single ship that at this distance looked so quiet, one could think of it as a peaceful sign or as a menace. The ocean rolled toward us. Surrounding Plymouth was the palisade, and past the palisade, the wolves. Wolves so close to resembling our companions, but not of our kinship, killing our swine and our cows. What swine and cows we had left foraged and trampled on the Wampanoag's crops. We erected more fences. We affirmed we were not at fault. I calculated incorrectly that the ship would be here before lunch. And this is fairly early in the novel too, and this is the first time we hear Eleanor Billington. "I'm leaving my house, right? John and our son already out in the fields. I'm getting the logs as one doth, minding my own, when those three steely faces turn to me. Oh, their chaste little bosoms, their pious little smiles. Women who think they are better than I, than us, the servants. But we weren't their servants, nay, not any longer. 1 year out of indentured servitude, but watching them look at me, you'd never know it. I took enough of those glances in London. I shan't be needing them now, mistresses," I yelled across the gardens. Alice, the governor's wife, covered her chest. Susanna put her hand on her hip. Elizabeth went back to her weed-pulling. Revelry it was to rile them. "Sing for your supper," that is what my mum did. "Sing for her bloody supper, and I did what I had to, did I not? To pay Weston for this journey, given how he lived on the Mayflower, on the wet ship with the rats nibbling our toes, he should have paid us. When my feet first fell upon this land, I had in mind to return to the ship's master and say, 'Take me back. This was not the ticket I purchased.' We agreed to 7 years of labor with respectable, ordinary English people. We agreed to 7 years of servitude in Virginia, not Plymouth. But oh no, William Bradford had an answer. 'My kind, my common kind, we are never given what we are promised.' It made our men sour to put up with what they did in England and in Plymouth, the chimney sweep boys, the Thames fetchers, when every man you walked by in London was a man thinking he could buy whatever he wished for, a biscuit, a black hen, a backside, and they could they not? That was these Puritans. You couldn't say that to their faces, though. They claimed it was slanderous. It wasn't. It was truth. I knew as soon as they put their self-righteous boots on the Mayflower, they would be trouble, asking us to quiet our singing, scowling when we passed the time by dancing. They would not let us return. The master of the ship said, like a magistrate, 'Sorry, Mrs. Billington, but there is not the food to feed you on a journey back to London.' And when our 7 years were complete, what did my husband get? What did we get for carrying all those weak, dying creatures, for surviving when most of them did not? The smallest plot in all the colony, that is what we got. So when these hypocrites looked their cherubic faces my way and claimed themselves to be the saints and I a stranger to God, they were as flimsy in mind and spirit as saplings. I feared them not and loved their surprise at my body self. With pleasure, my dears, with pleasure. Call me a groundling. But I dare you to call me a thief, a liar, or a whore. Sure, those Puritans did not say it to my face, but they knew what they were, and so did I, and God. I liked to remind them of that when they passed by me and glanced out of the corner of their eyes. When I saw Susanna hold her gaze at me and Alice tried not to, oh, what fun, oh, what joy it was to say, God is always watching, isn't he? I preferred my breath to be nice and garliced, keeping away the illnesses those dour ones kept giving us, the illness that killed my son, John. My sons, I did let them run. I did not keep them behind a fence. My boys could not even pretend to be a fox without those dire ones having their say in my child-rearing, tipping off the boys' fox ears and saying, if you disguise yourself, you betray God. I can stop right there.
Thank you. That's Tara Shay Nesbitt reading from Beheld. Elizabeth was certainly a fun character to write, I bet.
Oh, she was so fun. You know, I had written the novel from the first wife's perspective, Dorothy Bradford, and the second wife's perspective, Alice Bradford. And then I was teaching in London for a summer. I teach at Miami University, and I was teaching a summer program as part of Miami's programming. And I think being surrounded by so many dialects in London, I suddenly was like, if she were living now, she would have like a kind of Cockney accent. And I just could hear her and see her. And it was one of those really magical times in writing where I felt like I was following the writing, like images were appearing and I was just sort of following her and delighting in whatever she wanted to tell me. So she was a joy for sure.
This man, Newcomen, is that how it's pronounced? Newcomen?
Yeah.
Tell us about him.
Yeah, so I'm always like, how much do I tell in the story for people who don't have it ready yet? But John Newcomen was really a name in the archives, and really John Newcomen was the name from the court records. And I had seen somewhere that could also be used as a standard name for a person that you're like, they are a newcomer and you just don't know. You don't remember what their name is. But nothing really is on record about him other than the potential name. And so I started to imagine a story for him. So the same day that this ship is arriving with newcomers, a man named John Newcomen has made his way south to Plymouth, and he's arriving on, he's a newcomer too, but he's not on the ship and he's arriving separately. And that his presence, in the story, he has worked really hard and dreamed really big to get it into a better life. And he's left behind a woman that he wants to send for once he establishes, built a house, and then he wants to send for her. And so his desires are, you know, pretty, I just don't want to live like my family lived in London in this like tough place. And I want to have a little land and have a fresh start for the next generations. And that becomes complicated in the book.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Was Alice Bradford actually close to Dorothy, William's first wife? In the book, they are very, you know, childhood friends. Is that historically accurate?
So they lived in Holland together. But the way that I've seen it, so one of the things I looked at when I was starting to write the story is the marriage certificate. I found the marriage certificate between William Bradford and his first wife, Dorothy. And so the only thing I really have of Dorothy Bradford is her signature. And I had a colleague who knows Dutch read it to me, like, you know, read the certificate that they signed and like what they agreed to, which he says is just standard marriage stuff. But Dorothy was actually quite young, and she was younger than Alice. So in the real records, in actuality, Alice and William are pretty close in age, and Dorothy is younger. But in either I misremembered or this could have been true. I had her, the second wife, as the witness. And I, at this point, don't even know. I tried to go back because I was like, did I make that up? But I can't find it in the records who their witness was. They would have had one witness, but I don't know if it was her or not. So that was the hinge for me, that Alice was there at their wedding. but in reality, and that they lived in Holland and Leiden together, and that they were all immigrants. But in reality, there was enough of an age difference that I don't think they would have been able to be quite as close. They weren't the same age. She was a little bit older, so she would have had to have been more of a older sister figure, I think.
And Alice had been married previously?
Yes. So Alice marries a man by the name of Southworth. And so this was also true. They were to be on the ship together. So Alice and her husband and their kids they go through all the journey of like getting from Holland to England. And then there are all these delays and delays and delays because of the Speedwell and the captain maybe not wanting to go, or maybe the Speedwell was leaking or something. And during all that delay time, her husband is getting sick. And so because they have to combine people onto one ship, they needed people to turn away, to not go on the journey because there wasn't enough room. And Alice and her husband are one of those families that don't go on that initial trip. They get all the way to Plymouth, England, and then turn back. Probably because he was sick, because he did die a few months later. And Bradford really did send for her. And she really did, you know, come on a ship later. The timing is exactly right. Like those couple, I think it's exactly right. It's a couple years later that they get married. He establishes the community a little bit. And then that's the first wedding in Plymouth, is between Alice and William.
And she leaves her sons behind when she goes. Was that common that the early settlers would leave their children behind?
That's what it was really a mix. Like if you look at the list of who was on the Mayflower, there are a fair number of children and also a fair number of young servants. So it would just say like a person's name and you could tell if it was a man or a woman, or sometimes they would just say servant and then age. But there were a fair number of children, and of course there were births and on the ship. In part, I think they figured they would already be in Plymouth at the time, but because of the delays, the birth happened on the ship. But it was really striking to me that Dorothy Bradford, William Bradford's first wife, left their only child. It was also striking that they only had one child, because all their friends, it seemed like the norm was that you had a lot of children, and they only had one. So it seemed reasonable to me that they were experiencing pregnancy loss, or there were reasons why they weren't able to have more children. So that seemed also striking that they would have left that one child behind. Now, there aren't actually really records of, in the novel, I explore how I imagine that Dorothy is trying to get her son to come, and she's writing to her mom, and she's just trying to get back to her kid in some ways. Like, and I do think that's true. Like at moments of grief, questioning, you want to take something back, or you want to be close to the things you love so dearly. And I think that was probably really hard for her to have left her child. And I imagine it was put forth by her husband, who was like, you know, he'll be safer here. But I do strongly believe that she probably wanted to bring her son, and he didn't come over. Bradford didn't send for him until significantly later. So the novel really does, it was true that he doesn't come until like 10 years later. And on the novel, he comes on the same ship that these newcomers are arriving on.
Now, what about Alice's sons from her first marriage that she doesn't bring over initially? When do they come?
Yeah, I forget the date on that, but they did come. They came later. And I can see that. Like, I can see how there was a precedence for that. Like, you can see that in the records where it's like, then you add the kids on. Seems some people made the decision to bring their kids, and then some were like, well, let's get everything set up and then we'll bring for them. But I think I would imagine like a couple of years later, but in the case of in the novel, I say that her other kids hadn't come yet. And I think that they do come, but I'm not sure how much longer that is.
Yeah, because I think at the end of the novel, you talk about the older children being there and having a grandchild from one of them, or maybe from both of them. Yeah.
And that is true. Yeah, I think, now I can't totally remember, but I think I tried to keep the names somewhat in keeping with what I could find in the records.
So you did find historical records about these people?
Yes.
Was it hard to find them, or are they pretty accessible?
Yeah, there's a mix. Like, it's easy to find, you know, I could find Bradford's of Plymouth Plantation, the governor's like book about the people. And I went to the archives, and in Plymouth, there are a couple different places, the Plymouth Museum, and then a place that's been renamed Plymouth Patuxent, when I was researching, it was called the Plymouth Plantation. And you could find, from those two sites, there are transcriptions of different letters during the time period. Harder to find are things like, what were the women thinking? And for those things, I did try. So I would look at, so I think one of the storylines is a woman that's in grief, and she's missing her son, and she's had experienced infant loss, pregnancy loss. And when I was talking through that storyline with a person who is a scholar in early American lit, a male, he was saying like, well, they just thought about child loss differently back then. I was like, I don't think that's true. But because there were so many accounts only for men, it's like hard to show otherwise. So the way that I would do it is like, I'm going to find some letters from French women of the same time period and see what they think. And of course, like, no, everybody was, we've grieved through time. Like, that isn't, it wasn't different just because it happened more frequently. So things like that, where I'd find a kind of approximation. And then for understanding Native community perspectives, I read different books. Like there's a book called This Land Is Our Land and Our Beloved Kin. And then I emailed the scholars who had done that research, and their footnotes in the back were great for finding primary sources. And then I worked with a Wampanoag elder in conversation. So a lot of the Wampanoag community or Native American community materials weren't as accessible, but I was relying on people's stories as told down through generations, less than like, you know, here's the actual printed court record.
And they still share those stories? They're still being passed down orally?
I think there are probably all kinds of stories that I don't have any access to at all.
Right.
You know, like, I know. But like the Wampanoag communities are very strong and thriving within the Northeastern woodlands. And that, like, that should not have been new to me, but it was. And like language, keeping language and restoring language, and their work with the different history museums to make sure that their versions of the stories are at least acknowledged or given some space are really great. But yeah, no, there's definitely other versions that are getting told. And I think I can imagine that would be really difficult. Like, I don't want to talk to you. Like, you guys are the reason that I have to like have these arguments about what my land is, you know, but I'm sure it's all a negotiation, and different individual people have different ways of working with that. Yeah.
Now, Tara Shea, how long did you work on Beheld?
Ooh, I would say about 5 years. Because I wrote it, I started it in my PhD program, which I got at the University of Denver. And then I was writing and revising during the first 4 years of my work here at Miami, like my teaching job. So yeah, it was about 5 years. I didn't think it would take that long.
Do you start out primarily doing the research and then you start writing, or do you mix up both at the same time?
I do them at the same time. I came to the interest because of that one footnote. And then I felt like haunted by that
story of what could have happened to Dorothy Bradford. And I was definitely testing, like I would research a little bit and then I would test like, does this feel energetic to write or do I just think this would be a good idea? And I'm always kind of going back, like testing it for like, do I really have energy? Are the sentences coming like naturally? Is there a voice here? Or is this, does this just sound like it would be a good story? And in this one, there were, I felt the energy for it. And then I definitely move back and forth between the two. And at some points I stopped researching for a while when I find like for the same events, at least two different versions of what could have happened. Basically when people start arguing with one another in the archives or in the research. And I'm like, okay, I know enough to know that like nobody really knows what happened and now I could write.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or at least one account isn't the right one, I should say. And now I can write.
Were there other European countries that were settling areas of our country, right? Like
yes.
The French down in,
yes.
I'm assuming New Orleans area down there that was French, maybe? Am I right?
I don't know much about what was happening in that area, but there were definitely like they were strategizing to not be near the French and the Spanish.
Yeah, because the French were up, the French were up in Canada, uh-huh. The Spanish were further south on the East Coast, the Dutch were in the New York area.
Yes.
Yeah, so it was, and everything seemed up for grabs at the time. So
yeah.
We're almost out of time, but just real quickly, did you have a publishing contract while you were writing this, or did you find your publisher after you were complete?
I had a relationship with Bloomsbury, my publisher for my first book, and I chose not to try to sell this second book until I had finished it because I didn't want to be beholden to a storyline that I had proposed that which might not be what happens on the page. So I wrote the book and then my agent sold it to the editor that is wonderful, Nancy Miller, who I worked with at Bloomsbury for The Wives of Los Alamos too. So, and they had first, they call it first refusals. So they wanted the chance to take a look at it first. And I was happy to do that with them.
And what is the meaning of the title?
Well, Beheld came to me because it operates on a couple different ways. Behold coming as a familiar word within the Bible, so hopefully suggesting the religious context. And then beheld as in like to hold and to see what is beheld, like what has been held on to, what has been remembered, but what else there might be left to hold on to and remember and see. So it felt to me like a kind of intimate word, but also a word that could be suggestive of the time and suggestive of some of the themes that are coming up in the book.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Tara Shea. This was a very interesting book to read. The story gripped me. The characters were fascinating. And it's a different perspective of a story that we think we know.
And yeah, exactly.
And is that what you will do like with your next book? Are you doing something similar, giving a different perspective on something that we think we know?
You know, I'm going closer to home and I can't say too much about it, but it's not set so far in the past, but it does deal with a nationwide, maybe like big topic of the moment. But from the perspective of people that maybe get lesser, that are lesser heard, but it's still so much in process. I don't want to take any.
I understand, I'll look forward to seeing what that is. And Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
Yes, I do. In history, we wonder whose stories get told over time, who gets believed, and subsequently, who gets punished. And we find out sometimes, and sometimes we don't.
Well, thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Bye-bye.